Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Imagine the president calls, says he wants you to run the federal budget. Great, you say, and then you remember the budget cuts. Welcome to the worst job in Washington. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
This is the Marketplace podcast for Monday, the 4th of March. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on day three of what looks to be a long haul while Congress and the president continue to disagree about how to handle the federal budget. That gets us, quite conveniently, to the news of the day. Sylvia Matthews-Burwell, presently the head of the Walmart Foundation, has worked in the Office of Management and Budget, the OMB, before. Someone can assume she knows what she's getting into as she decides to run the place. Of course, you know that old saying about what happens when you assume? Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson gets us going today.
If you hear budget director and think pencil pusher, take that image and merge it with a lion tamer. There, that is closer to the role of the director of the OMB. Jim Miller would know. He was the budget director under President Reagan.
Well, you have to have a lot of skills. One is you need to be a geek of sorts. You need to be an accountant of sorts. You need to be an economist.
Of sorts, plus have enough political savvy to negotiate a Washington where everyone wants something from you. And with the sequester in full swing,
I just can't imagine taking over as director of OMB at a more difficult time.
Isabel Sahil, with the Brookings Institution, worked in the OMB under President Clinton. She says the job now will be lots of budget cutting with no way to soften the blows.
You will have no candy to give out. So you have no way to sort of sweeten any of your requests. It's all going to be pain all the time.
But lest you think the new director will be short on friends, not so. Jeffrey Berry is a professor of political science at Tufts University. He says the OMB director is the gatekeeper to the president and the country's purse strings. So if confirmed, Burwell will be one powerful woman.
This is also a time to shine. So yes, it's high stress, but there's a risk-reward that could make the new OMB director a star.
What's that old proverb? May you live in interesting times? These times could be both a blessing and a curse for the new budget director. In New York, I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
There were other executive branch vacancies filled today. Secretary of Energy, for one, as well as a new head of the Environmental Protection Agency. Gina McCarthy is her name. And she is also going to have her hands full, in part because late Friday afternoon, the State Department came out with a draft report on the controversial Keystone XL pipeline, the one that's going to bring crude from the oil sands up in Canada down to American ports. The State Department said building it would have no additional impact on climate change, good or bad, because the oil would just get to market by train instead. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Eve Troe explains.
Michael Levy at the Council on Foreign Relations says pipelines are the cheapest way to move oil, about $5 a barrel. And sure, the oil companies up in the Canadian tar sands would prefer to spend that.
But if it turns out they need to spend $20 a barrel to move it by rail, they're going to do that instead of leaving this $100 a barrel oil in the ground.
Since railroads already carry tar sands oil and plan to carry much more, it doesn't matter if the Keystone XL pipeline gets built or not. From a climate change perspective, that's what the new State Department report says, that the tar sands oil is going to get transported and burned, and its greenhouse gases will go into the air no matter what. But Anthony Swift with the Natural Resources Defense Council says not building the pipeline buys more time.
One of the first steps to addressing climate change is to stop making things worse. Keystone XL clearly would make things worse. More tar sands will be produced more quickly.
Instead of giving the U.S. a chance to cut back on oil consumption. Jeff Elliott follows rail transport at Oliver Wyman. He says no one can predict how much oil will move by rail in the next few years.
It's hard enough to see your hand in front of your face, much less, you know, the horizon.
He says tar sands oil is so thick, it's easier in a way to put it in a rail car than dilute it to flow through a pipeline. And so rail business for oil is bound to keep growing, no matter what happens with Keystone XL. I'm Eve Troe for Marketplace.
Slow start, strong finish at the corner of Wall Street and Broad on this Monday. We will have the details when we do the numbers. If you want to get a decent job in this economy, it behooves you to have a college education. That's the conventional wisdom, which has the added benefit of being true, because companies pretty much demand a bachelor's degree. But in the same breath, employers also complain that today's college graduates just aren't cutting it. They don't have the skills it takes. We wanted to understand why that is. So we teamed up with the Chronicle of Higher Education to do some research to find out exactly what those prospective employers want. And to do it, we put one of those dissatisfied hiring managers in a room with a soon-to-be college graduate for a sort of mock job interview. From the education desk at WYPR, Marketplace's Amy Scott has our story.
Our job seeker is Moria Aberetti. He's a 21-year-old senior at Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond, a computer science major with a B average.
I'm actually double majoring with economics.
Right, a computer science econ major with a B average. He shows up in a jacket and tie.
Moria, nice to meet you.
Hi, I'm Dave Boyce. Glad to have you here.
David Boyce, no tie, runs a technology consulting firm called Sine Nomine Associates. That's Latin for without a name. The company of about 20 employees is based in Ashburn, Virginia, outside D.C. It does everything from data center design to strategic planning for businesses like IBM and Cisco.
They'll ask us, how do we take this from an idea to something that they can actually build and or do?
Boyce typically hires recent college grads as entry-level analysts. They do a lot of the research to bring those ideas to life. Boyce, one of the employers in our survey, and Aberetti, our willing victim, take a seat at the conference table, and the grilling begins.
Is there some way where you've been asked to work in a team to take an abstract idea and make it concrete? And if so, how?
Well, there was this one particular class I took called Design Implementation and Practicum, mm-hmm. where we had to design program. It was a little game. It's just a little Mario kind of game.
So far, so good. Yeah, Aberetti seems to be avoiding one pitfall in the job hunt, not being prepared. Two-thirds of employers in our survey said grads need work on their interviewing skills. Boyce gets more specific.
How did you kind of develop the idea for the game?
We had requirements on what we had to have in the game. Mm-hmm. And then from there, we just threw around ideas.
So more of an organic kind of, hey, I thought of this.
And yeah.
That's not what Boyce wants to hear. He was hoping for something a little more thought out.
We find that a lot of people, and not just new college grads, aren't getting that skill set. How you put an idea forward. How do you support it? How do you build it? How do you put the facts behind it? All of those things are really critical.
Boyce sounds like a lot of the employers who responded to our survey. More than half of them said they have trouble finding qualified people for job openings. They said recent grads too often don't know how to communicate effectively, and they have trouble adapting, problem solving, and making decisions, things employers say they should have learned in college. That's why everyone Boyce hires goes through a year-long training program.
This is a significant investment. This is something where the company puts probably about $250,000 into every single new hire.
In terms of training?
In terms of training. That's what it costs us for the time, but that's the kind of value that we get out of it.
The training covers basics, like how to write an effective business document, and throws in some philosophy and history.
We ask people to read Cato the Elder. We ask people to read Suetonius.
Whoa, whoa. What? Okay, job seekers, you better brush up on your early Roman history.
We do that because we ask them to look at the abstract process of organizing ideas.
Sounds a lot like an argument for liberal arts education at a time when more students are being told to study science and technology as a path to a career. The firm that did the survey says the findings suggest colleges should break down the, quote, false dichotomy of liberal arts and career development. They're intrinsically linked. Or, as Boyce puts it,
we don't need monofocused people. We need well-rounded people.
And that's from a tech employer. For his part, Aberetti says he's had a well-rounded education at Virginia Commonwealth. Granted, there was no Suetonius in the mix, but he took rhetoric along with courses on data structures and algorithm analysis. And he did something else that employers really go crazy for.
I did an internship.
And that brings us to one of the most surprising things we learned from our survey. In industries across the board, employers viewed an internship as the single most important credential for recent grads, more than where you went to school or what you majored in, even your grades.
I learned a lot more from that internship than I did in school. It's different kind of learning.
After a few more questions, things start looking up for Abaretti, and what began as a mock interview looks like it could turn into a real job.
You've made a pretty good case in terms of thinking, because there's somebody you would be interested in talking to more. And so the next steps would be...
Outside, I ask Abaretti how he thinks it went, and whether Boys is asking a lot of someone fresh out of school, or if his university didn't deliver. What he says surprises me.
I think it's more up to a student than the university, because the university can only do a certain amount. The school can't teach you everything. You have to do something on your own. Some things on your own, yeah.
Back inside, David Boys says he wasn't just being polite. He might take a chance on a job candidate like Abaretti.
It is something where we would have to make those investments in him. Is he worth it? We'd have to see. But on the other hand, I think he has a chance. And certainly, you know, if he sends me a resume, I would probably look at it.
Abaretti says he will. He graduates in the fall. In Ashburn, Virginia, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
We've got the complete results of the survey we commissioned with the Chronicle of Higher Education on our homepage, plus a quiz to see how you'd stack up in today's job market. Could be scary. It's at marketplace.org. You know how your parents always said not to put money in your mouth because you don't know where it's been? Well, Steve Boggan knows where his money's been, or at least one particular $10 bill. He started in Lebanon, Kansas, close, he figured, to the center of the country, and for 30 days and 30 nights followed his 10 spot wherever it went for a total of 3,300 miles around the American heartland. His book about the adventure is called Follow the Money. Steve, it's good to talk to you.
Hello, Kai.
Let's review the logistics here for a second. You marked up this bill so that you'd be able to spot it in a dark and smoky bar or in some crowded store, right? So you knew which one you were following.
Yes.
And then how did it go at the point of sale when the bill changed hands? Did you literally just say, hi, I'm following the money?
Yes. What I had to do before each person spent the money, they tell me what they were going to do. I would go up to the next recipient and say, look, you know, this guy or this woman is about to spend a $10 bill. I've been following that $10 bill, and I'd like to carry on following. Will you cooperate? And everybody said yes.
Hmm. You found yourself becalmed a number of times when that bill just had nowhere to go. Stores were closed. I mean, the first place you went to, Lebanon, Kansas, there was almost no place to spend that money.
No, there wasn't. I think I had two shops in town. Three shops. Hmm. And come 4 o'clock on Saturday, everything closed and nothing opened again until Monday. Now, that meant that the guy who had the $10 bill at that time, it meant that on the Sunday, I got to follow him around and he introduced me to farmers. There were an aging group of farmers. And it meant that I was able to get a snapshot of this way of life, which frankly was dying.
What if somebody had put this in the bank or put it in a church collection plate? I mean, there are any one of a number of ways this thing could have gone horribly wrong and you'd have been home in 3 days.
Completely, I agree. They say that the mere act of observing an experiment affects its outcome. That is essentially, I think, what happened. So if your next question, which it might have been, was, you know, is this a true journey of a $10 bill? I can't say for sure, but I doubt it very much.
Who sticks with you of all the people you met? I mean, what stands out? What'd you take home with you?
The most fun time I had was when the $10 bill was paid to the lead singer in a blues band in Arkansas. Mm-hmm. And those guys held on to me a little bit longer than I think they needed to.
I think you wanted to stay. You were drinking a lot of beer and hanging out with these guys. I read that part of the book, man.
I was drinking a lot of beer and hanging out with these guys, and they were wonderful.
When was the last time you saw this bill?
This morning. At the very end, the last guy to have it, who was a car worker in Detroit, he saw me looking at the bill in his wallet. And he said, look, I'm not going to go anywhere. I'm not going to spend the money. Do you want it back? So I gave him another $10, and I got to keep the original $10.
Steve Boggan, his book is called Follow the Money, A Month in the Life of a $10 Bill. Steve, thanks a lot.
Thank you, too.
Coming up.
You know how when you go to the car dealership, you go see that other guy for financing? We need to get one of those, like, come talk to this guy to sign you up for a credit card, you know, for your bespoke shoes.
The disappearing and not cheap art of handmade shoes. But first, let's do the numbers. Modest gains on Wall Street today, as if nothing had happened over the weekend in Washington. Imagine that. The Dow Industrials added 38 points today, 0.25%. 14,127 for the blue chips. The NASDAQ gained 12 points, 0.4%, 3182. The S&P 500 up 7 points, 0.4%, finished at 1525. Airlines had a good day on this Monday. United Continental lifted 5.25%. Delta climbed more than 5.5%. Alaska Air up 4%. Great story in the New York Times this weekend, by the way, about Alaskan Air. AutoNation gained nearly 2% today as it reported an increase in retail sales for February. Caterpillar down 1.75%, while United Technologies shaved more than 1% today. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the House Agriculture Committee holds a hearing on the state of the rural economy. Comedian Penn Jillette, one half of the duo Penn and Teller, turns 58. And March is National Craft Month. Time to bedazzle something. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. As the budget cuts grind their way through the economy over the next however long it is until Washington gets its act together, we're all going to be hearing a lot about taxes, as in the president saying he wants a balanced approach and House Republicans saying taxes are off the table. Some new analysis by the Tax Policy Center suggests that taxes for the 1%, those for whom taxes would presumably be going up, are as high as they have been since 1979. Context being everything, that does kind of make one ask, who was the 1% in 1979? Marketplace's David Weinberg has that story.
The year is 1979, and you are rich. You're driving down the coast in your Lamborghini. Donna Summer is blasting out of your state-of-the-art tape deck. You are a 1%er, which means...
adjusted for inflation to be in the top 1%, you know, the cutoff was about $215,000, $220,000.
Steve Kaplan was a bright-eyed 19-year-old at Harvard in 1979. Now he's a professor at Chicago Booth. He says that most 1%ers in 79 worked as executives and managers at companies like Exxon and General Motors. 16% worked in the medical profession, 7% were lawyers, and 8% worked in finance. Fast forward to today, and for the most part, these percentages haven't changed much. What has changed significantly is the rate at which 1% incomes have grown compared to the rest of the country, especially for those in finance.
Financial professionals in the top 1% of the income distribution in 2005 were getting about 3.5 times as much of the nation's income as they were back in 1979.
John Bacchia at Williams College researched jobs and income growth of top earners. He says tax rates for the wealthy have actually gone down since 1979.
So the Congressional Budget Office estimates that all federal taxes were about 35% of income for people in the top 1% of the income distribution in 1979.
In 2009, the last year data is available, the rate was around 29%. That was before January's increase in the top rate. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
Here's a fairy tale with a very unhappy ending. Jack the Giant Slayer, the movie based loosely on the story of Jack and the Beanstalk that opened this weekend, only made $28 million at the box office. Yes, a lot in absolute terms, but a trifle considering Warner Brothers is said to have spent more than $200 million to get the thing made. A big chunk of that budget went into special effects, and Disney takes up the special effects cause this weekend with its own wonder, Oz the Great and Powerful, which, according to the New York Times, tips the balance sheet at $325 million. We sent Marketplace's Queen of Kim to find out what kind of special effects you get for that kind of money.
Forget Dorothy. The hero of Oz the Great and Powerful is Oscar Diggs, a huckster magician played by James Franco.
Am I dreaming?
You're in Oz.
royal treasure of Oz.
The trailer promises an eye-popping 21st century Oz, thanks to the wonders of CGI or computer-generated imagery. And that comes with a hefty price tag. Jason E. Squire is a professor of film at the University of Southern California.
There are two major costs for movies. There's budget and there's marketing.
Squire says that Disney is probably spending about $125 million for marketing. As for the rest of the $200 million?
It basically comes down to CGI.
Despite such flops like Jack the Giant Slayer and Disney disaster John Carter, a sci-fi movie that was chock full of CGI, studios continue to make a huge investment in special effects. Porter Bibb is with Media Tech Capital Partners.
It seems to be the only way that the target moviegoers, 18 to 24, will pay to come to see a movie in a theater.
He says young moviegoers make up about 80% of the theater-going audience.
I'm not sure I buy into that theory.
Hal Vogel is a longtime entertainment analyst.
The box office, in terms of admissions, has been sluggish for now for about 10 years.
He says no amount of special effects has changed that. In San Francisco, I'm Queenie Kim for Marketplace.
Over the next 10 years, there are going to be 1,400 fewer shoemakers in this country than there are right now. That's what the Bureau of Labor Statistics says anyway. A cold, somewhat antiseptic item. Not unlike, I dare say, the shoes you are wearing. Made overseas, probably mass-produced in a factory somewhere. So today, as part of our series on disappearing jobs, shoes like they used to be made. Custom-fitted, made to order by hand. The hands, in this case, of Raul Ojeda. We spoke in his workshop just a couple of weeks ago.
I'll tell you, when you walk in this door, it smells like leather and wood and polish. I mean, it smells great.
Yeah, no, it's so sad that we don't smell that anymore because we work here every day. This is a great shop. It's got really high ceilings and great ventilation, but those particular scents stay in the air, and it's really good.
Shoemaking is not a thing you find out in the economy much anymore. Bespoke shoemaking like you do, and much less with a young guy like yourself. What does it mean that it's disappearing a little bit from this economy?
It has always been almost a pass down through generations thing, more so than something you learn in school. And for a long time, I've experienced that in my own ethnic group. Our parents decided they were going to work really hard and give us some money to go to school so that we didn't have to work as hard as they did. I think that was a big mistake because now you have kids of my age that don't know how to do anything. You don't have a lot of craftsmen being trained by their families anymore.
What's the most surprising thing about this job, the thing that nobody really knows?
Well, I think what's more surprising to me is that a lot of people don't know about the existence of shoe repair shops. I get a lot of first-timers like, oh, I never knew I could do this to my shoe. That's always gives us huge potential possibilities because if before you knew that you could fix your shoes, you'd never get them fixed. And now you may start to actually take care of them.
Now, if I walk in the door and I say, Raul, I want you to make me a pair of shoes, what's going to happen? What are you going
to
do?
Well, really, we need to have a conversation of what you're going to use the shoe for, how often you're going to use it, and what's really the reason you want to get the shoe.
I'm going to wear them once a week, maybe once every 2 weeks, because I want to splurge, and I'm going to wear them in an office casual environment. A nice brown leather monk strap, right? I don't want lace-ups. I want monk straps. Actually, this is true. I've been dying for a good pair of monk strap shoes.
You should see our classic a double monk strap that is just beautiful.
Now, how much is that going to cost me?
Oh, boy. With the
understanding that I'm making an investment, right? I mean, you go buy a suit, you go buy a nice pair of shoes, it's an investment.
The first shoe, it will run you $1,600.
Okay, that's not cheap.
That's not cheap. That will be probably the best fitted shoe you'll have.
Yeah. So now I have to convince my wife that I'm going to spend $1,600 on a pair of shoes? Is that where we are?
You know, I was thinking for a long time. You know how when you go to the car dealership, you go see that other guy for financing? We need to get one of those, like, come talk to this guy to sign you up for a credit card, you know, for your bespoke shoes. The idea, though, is to really fill everyone with the idea that you can no longer buy shoes from the store.
You can have a look at Raul Ojeda and his shop and hear other stories of disappearing jobs at marketplace.org. While you're there, drop us a line. Let us know if your job is disappearing too. I'm still negotiating those shoes, by the way.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, the first and last time you will hear the words Harlem Shake pass my lips. If you don't know what that is, consider yourself lucky. If you do, you should know that doing it at work can now get you fired. The Australian mining company Barminco has dismissed as many as 15 miners for doing the dance on the job and videotaping it. The video, the company said, violated its core values of safety, integrity, and excellence, to which I can only add, and common sense as well. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Our producers include Bridget Bodner, Mary Dew, Nancy Fargali, Millie Jefferson, John Ketchum, Megan Larson, Jolie Podokas, and Chow Too. Thanks today to the staff here at KPBS. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back in L.A. tomorrow, everybody. And this is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.